Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Linda Kamau. She's the lead developer at Ushahidi and one of the co-founders at Akira Chicks, and she's talking to me from Nairobi, Kenya. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm glad to talk to you. I saw you just a few weeks ago, and now with the power of the internet, we're having an interview that that I promised you that we'd do, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy morning.
No worries. I'm happy to do it.
Cool. So you are the lead developer at Ushahidi, and you've been there for quite a few years, haven't you?
Yeah, I have actually turned 7 in a couple of weeks, actually, by April 1st. Yeah.
All right. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And did you get that job out of school, or have you? How did you end up at Ushahidi?
So I was actually a volunteer at Ushahidi when it started back in 2008. Actually, I started volunteering in 2008, and at that time I was working. I was an intern at an organization where we were just doing web development, so just building websites. And then at the same time when I was in that organization, I was still doing my undergraduate degree. And so after graduating, I moved jobs and got a junior developer position in a company where we were building mobile money application and basically like a competitor for M-Pesa. And I didn't even last there for long because I was still contributing to Ushahidi on my spare time. And so that's when Ushahidi poached me. Eric poached me and got me to join Ushahidi in 2010.
Yeah, that's Eric Herd, Eric Herzman, one of the kind of people who started off Ushahidi. Now, what does Ushahidi mean?
Ushahidi means testimony or witnessing. It's a Swahili word. And so the idea is basically the citizen or the crowd being able to report what they're seeing based on a scenario. For instance, during an election, people being able to send in SMSs saying either one, they've gone to their polling station and found that either there are no ballot boxes or the polling station is not opened. So basically giving the crowd the power to actually report what they see rather than relying on mainstream journalism.
Well, that sounds like something that would be useful not just in Kenya. Are other countries using it?
Yeah, we have. We've deployed the platform in more than, I think, 100 countries now, and it's translated. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's translated into about 50 languages, different languages, because of the different places like French and Portuguese and such kind. And so it's used for, and it's been used for different things. For instance, election, mapping the crisis in Syria, reporting on, simple things like mapping out the burger places in Atlanta, the best burger places, like fun things like those. And then even just, I think also for people who are doing, schools have used it to actually be able to teach students on the power of crowdsourcing and tools like that that are being used to give to make people raise their voices. So yeah, it's been used in like all manners of scenarios, but I think the main one is mainly crisis and election. Those are the two main areas that we've seen that it being mostly used. Like right now, I think we've seen a deployment of people trying to map out the drought that is in Somalia, and that's about to turn into actually a famine. And even like the crisis in Syria, that one is still running till now. It's the longest running deployment of Ushahidi. I think Syria has been going on for a very long time. So yeah, those are the kind of use cases that you've seen come up.
Wow. It seems to me, just from a historical perspective, it's one of the first really successful examples of crowdsourcing, isn't it? Getting lots of incredibly valuable data into one place from the power of the crowd.
Yes, yes, actually. And I think that's why it's been used really widely, because it's very easy to just get information from people from just the basic thing that everybody has, a mobile phone, where they just send an SMS and they can be able to actually contribute to, let's say, an election or a crisis. So just, I think, using with the power that everybody has, which is basically their handset, irrespective whether it's a smartphone or a feature phone, you know, like, I think that's how, that's why it has been one of the most successful, because you don't get people to go looking for other tools to be able to, like, use it.
How do the feature phone people talk to Shahidi with SMS? Is it a structured text message? Do they know how to send commands, or do you have to parse it somehow?
So most of the times, we ask people to go ahead and, like, when we're doing an election, we have to, like, for instance, here in Kenya, the coming election is in August. So what we've been doing is trying to get people, you communicate, you do a lot of marketing by communicating to people and telling them, if you're going to send an SMS, make sure it has a location or where you are at, and basically the message. So we tell people to say, like, oh, the polling station is not opened in Kibera. So you don't just say polling station is not open. Just say polling station is open in Kibera. But we still do receive people who just say polling station not reported. So what we've done a message threading behind in the platform, and so we are able to actually have a conversation with the people behind. So because you have administrators who are receiving the raw data and translating that into posts. So the people who are doing that, they actually go ahead back and forth with the person and go like, so where are you reporting at? And they'll say Kibera or say Kibera Ayani. And so the administrators are able to map out and see that that's Kibera Ayani and actually put an be able to produce a post with a map on it, with a marker on it, on the map.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that sounds like an opportunity for some kind of a bot framework. Right now you say you have a human talking sometimes to the to get more detail.
Yeah.
You could teach a bot, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we've been thinking about for the longest time ever. I think resource-wise, we've been constrained, but I think it's one of the things that we are hoping with time we can actually just figure out and be able to come up with, a bot that can actually help us figure that out. Because it's really like it's really time-consuming, and also you have to have a lot of, we have to recruit volunteers. Like for the Kenyan election, right now we start recruiting volunteers and start training them on how to like do the whole mapping of reports and or posts. And that means that we'll have to incur cost of the fact that during that day of the election, you have to host them like in a space, in a what you call the situation room. You have to make sure there's food, there's all that stuff. So it's more like it actually becomes a whole activity, because I think they always say tech is 10%, humans is 90%. I think we really have the 90% a lot. Yeah.
Sounds like it. Well, how about after we're done on the podcast, I'll try to connect you to the people who use the Microsoft bot framework.
Oh, sure.
Maybe they can help you do that work without you having to write that part.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
All right, cool. So you are the lead dev now at Ushahidi. But when you started, you said that you were kind of a junior developer. Now you're a senior. You're the boss. You are you're the dev. You're the boss dev.
Yes, I mean, the fact that I've been here a long time, and I mean, I've seen, we worked on version 2 of our platform. That's after the first one. The first one was basically, the legacy one was mainly actually on ESP or VB, actually, VB.net. And so when we transitioned to PHP, and that was our version 2, which is what has been running for the longest time ever. But I led that one. And then after that, we started building our new version, which is the version 3 of the platform. And so still part of it. And then at the same time, I took a step, I kind of said, I'm done working on platform. I need something else new. And so started working on a new product that we're doing. It's called Roll Call, and it's basically a checking tool during emergencies. So that's what I've been leading now, and still working with the rest of the devs on the platform team. So, yeah.
Okay. So Ushahidi has the CrowdMap product.
Yeah.
And then the older Swift River, and now one called Roll Call.
So Swift River actually is legacy. We are no longer working on it or supporting it. I think it's anyone who just gets it, they can go ahead and work on it. And then CrowdMap, we are sunsetting CrowdMap because with a new platform, we are moving to we're moving everything that's on CrowdMap into the new platform, the V3 one, which is ushahidi.io. So we are also going to be sunsetting CrowdMap, and now it will be ushahidi.io because it's a new, it's newer, and there's not so much support of the old one, V2, which CrowdMap is on V2. So we are transitioning everyone onto V3.
Nice. Okay. So you're, you've really gone from building, if I may, an app to now a platform.
Yes.
And this platform is what everything else, that's the future of your whole system.
Yes, exactly.
Very cool. Yeah. And then Roll Call, people can look at it at rollcall.io. And this is for, like, you know, people checking in. Did they land safely? Are they okay? Is everyone okay in an emergency?
Yes, exactly. And I think one of the biggest use cases that we've seen from Roll Call, or the people who have been asking for it, are actually embassies, because being able to, like, check on their people when something happens, like during Westgate here, in when it happened, basically when Roll Call was born, things are born here out of crises. So yeah, when Westgate happened, that's when Roll Call was born. And I think for us, we remember the Swedish embassy going like, it would be really nice to have something like this when Westgate happened, because it was very hard to tell whether our people were actually like at Westgate. So it would be nice if we could have sent a blast message instead of like sending emails, because not everybody reads emails on their phones. Emails, most people actually end up reading them on their computers. And especially on a weekend, people are actually on just on their phones. So it would have been nice if they could have sent a blast and just checked on anyone, everyone, and be able to at least account for most of the Swedish people. And so from that, we realized actually it's the people who need it are actually people who are really working with bigger groups of people, and in crisis-prone countries like the UN, working in Somalia and in the different places where the environment is volatile. So yeah, so Roll Call was born out of that, and currently actually we are doing our tests without some trusted testers and getting our feedback, because we've just put out the alpha. And then based on that, then we should be able to actually roll out, if possibly in the mid this year with some users. And yeah, so Roll Call is more a paid application or paid platform actually. And so so it's not more on the free version like the platform is. So platform is both free and we have a SaaS model, but you can actually download and install it on yourself. But we haven't done that for Roll Call. We haven't open sourced it yet. We will with time, but I think we're just starting out with people who can actually, clients who can actually just go ahead and pay up for it. So the way we actually built both Roll Call and platform, we're trying to use the same stack. And so currently we can actually switch developers from any of the two different platforms. So you can, a developer can be on Roll Call the next 2 weeks, and can be on platform the other next 2 weeks, like that, because at least we are trying to making sure that we have the same stack when building the platforms, both of them.
That's actually a really good opportunity for us to pivot the conversation, because you wanted to tell me kind of how you came up in software, and how you kind of learned software, became a developer, and you just described, you know, not just the growing up of your stack, but the way that you grew as a software architect. Like, you've now helped build and architect a stack that many people can use. People can be easily migrated from one product to the other.
Yeah.
You know, that's not junior developer stuff. You learned that with your coworkers and your teammates over the last, you know, almost decade of writing software that's being used by, I don't know, millions of people.
Oh yeah.
how did this all start? Where did you start in software?
I actually started in high school. So when I was in high school, when we joined what we call Form 1 here, which is, I think, grade, I'm not sure there's 9 or something. But when we joined Form 1, the school I went to, it was a boarding school. And so there were computers, but there were those old computers. People just used to go to the computer room to just learn typing Twitter, like just be able to learn typing Twitter. But by the time it was Form 2, they had a new computer lab, and they had put up new computers. And so we actually did have classes that we used to go and learn computers. And so I got interested, because I really loved the fact that, like, the teacher would show us some code, and I'm like, that's interesting. That doesn't sound like English. Neither does it sound like Swahili. Neither does it sound like my mother tongue. but I think I'm interested in learning it. Like it really, like the numbers and the whole logic thinking really intrigued me. And I really love mathematics and physics. So having another thing on top of it was like, I was really happy about it. So in school, we used to choose the subjects we do when we get to Form 2, and nobody used to choose computers. Like anyone who went into computers was because one, they were pushed out of the other subjects by the teachers. And so they had no option but to just take computers, because people used to go like, it's hard. And it's actually girls, it's even worse, because we have this notion that it's something hard. It's a man's world. So people never actually need to take it up. I actually signed up for the computing club and the computing subject. And the teachers were like, what? You could actually excel in commerce. And I'm like, no, I don't think I want to do commerce. Business is not my thing when it comes to that. Like I will do business to just pass the exam and that's it. So I took up computers, and in Form 2, actually, I was busy doing projects for the Form 4s, the guys who are like two years ahead of me when they were doing their final projects. They'll come and I'd help them out. Well, I'd get like, you know, biscuits, you know, getting biscuits in school was hard. So at least I'll get biscuits, or someone will offer to do my laundry because I've done their code or worked on their project. And so that's, my interest was basically sparked in school, and I knew I wanted to do computers irrespective. And after even coming out of school and joining university, they actually, so we select universities and the courses that we want to take up. And then based on the grade that you get, they'll actually choose who joins what, because there are cutoff points for each of them. And so I was thrown into doing Bachelor of Commerce, and I actually refused to join the school. I was like, there was no way I was going to do Bachelor of Commerce. I tried getting them to change it to give me a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science, but they say that the cutoff point, I'd not met the cutoff point. I actually missed the cutoff point with just 2 points. And so I
do
really...
Do you think that was because of your gender, that they were pushing you? Like you said that they were pushing you at the beginning. And yeah. Here they're trying to steer you into a degree that you don't want.
Yeah, I think... I still think that was the case, because even when you look at, still today, when you look at the enrollments for computer science degrees, they are more male than female. And it's not that the female don't actually excel. Like last year's results, the female are the ones who are leading. But even by the time they are giving out the courses, they'll push the ladies to the less, in quotes, hard stuff. So there'll be commerce, law, and all that. So they cannot push people, the ladies more on that side rather than pushing them on the engineering side.
Do you think that they're doing this consciously? Do you think the men in the department are just trying to cause trouble? Or do you think that they just don't understand that, like, they can't believe how talented women developers can be? Like, I'm trying to understand the root of it.
I don't think they understand that actually women can actually be real good developers or engineers. So it's not done consciously, but I think it's just a culture problem. Actually, let's even start there, where most people have believed that women should be taking the softer skills, you know, and men should be the ones being encouraged to get into computing. Like, for instance, at home, when I was growing up, we were just two in our family, me and my brother. My brother is older than me. And I'd see him like try, take the radio and try like play around with it. And I think he'd fix things when things are not working. And so I'd go like, even me, I can try it. And I'm like, let's work together. And you could see it from my mom's side that anytime anything was breaking in the house, it was my brother to fix it. And there's a time I was like, I can also fix it. So it's basically a culture problem that people think that the women are meant to be doing the softer skills than the men should be thrown in the harder stuff, specifically engineering and computing and all that. Yeah.
When you were doing your degree, your form one through four, didn't you become tired? Weren't you just like, forget it, I'll just do something else? Because it sounds like you fought every step of the way.
Yeah. What people tell me, well, my temperament is actually, I'm a choleric, and I do not give up. There's one thing I don't do is that I'll push and push. And I think that spirit or that kind of the trait is basically what gets me going. So even in school, I didn't give up. And in fact, because of that, then the computer studies teacher had an interest in me. The fact that I was able to write code more, because in the normal day, people, because it was very hard for people to write code, the teacher would actually do three quarter the code and then just tell the person to finish up. But I ended up doing even extra, and I would question some of what he wrote. So I think he got curious, and he actually ended up having to go ask the principal to exclude me from any extracurricular activities when I was in like my last year, because it's like, this one just needs to write code. That's all she just wants. And she wants to concentrate and finish and get her project. And I actually did pass because I got an A, a straight A in my computer studies. And that's because he had seen that I really, really wanted to do so. And even after coming out of school, before joining like a mainstream university, I think I just spent my time going to the cyber cafe because I didn't own a computer of myself. I come from a really humble background. So that time my mom was not able to buy me a computer. And so I used to just go like, I'll tell her, I'll clean the house and clean the dishes, but she'll pay me. And then the money she pays me is actually to go to the cyber. So I'd wake up very early in the morning when everyone else is going to work and school, and I'll clean up and then get my money. It's just like 100 shillings, which is like, I don't know, it's like how much. It's like $1. And then just go to the cyber cafe and just spend like half my day there with my diskettes, because that time we were using diskettes to store our work, with my diskettes on the project I did in school, and just go try like improve it and just make it much better. So that's how I spent my time actually before I actually joined normal learning university. So the choices that I had, I think my mom allowed me to just like be me and not force me into things, although her relatives were the opposite, where my uncle was like, what is computers? What are you doing? What is computers? You're just learning typing. You should do that and maybe you just do something like CPA and ACCA. I was like, guys, I didn't even do business in school. Like, why would you want me to go do business? It's like, no, you should be like your aunt who's done up to CPAK. I was like, yeah, that's because it's her and it's not me. So let's just be. So, but my mom is a little bit easy, and she was like, I see what's coming from. And then also my brother had just done a diploma in IT, and I think he knew and saw what was going on. So he was more of a support system to me and telling my mom how valuable computers were. So I think I had support at least from that side. And that's how I ended up actually choosing what I did. And I ended up doing just programming in school. There were some little other courses, but not so many. So I didn't even concentrate on them. And yeah, by the time I was actually getting into my final year, now I had the internship and was doing an internship, and at the same time doing my final year as an evening class student, and then grew into that, into a junior developer, and then finally got poached by USAID. So yeah.
So what are you doing to make it easier for the next women? I know that USAID is one of the things that you do, but Akira Chicks is also something that's important to you that will hopefully make the experience for the next young woman in Kenya not so difficult.
Yeah, so we realized, when I was working, before I joined USAID, I was working in a company where we were sharing an office space with another organization. So there were just two IT companies sharing office space. And my company, we had several ladies, yes, but most of them were doing design, others marketing. So I was still the one who was coding. And so when we had a joint event with the other company was just full of men. Like, I think you could count the number of women. There were like two or three. And when you ask them, they were in finance. So when we used to go for lunch, they used to worry, what do you guys do? They also thought that most of us were actually doing marketing or design or such kind of things. Until one day when we had a joint event and they came to our side of the office only to find us with a black screen because we were working on Linux then. So they're like, what, you guys are programmers? I was like, yeah, we are. You're actually developers. And I was like, oh, so actually, people still do not know that women can actually be software developers. So we're like, okay, how do we change this whole thinking that only men can actually be in the software world? And so we started thinking about it, and we realized that the problem is far-fetched. It's from when we are taking careers or choosing our subjects in school. So we decided, why not start out doing outreaches in schools, in girls' schools, and showing them opportunities that are there in the engineering world, in STEM, basically. Because people do career fairs in school, but they used to just bring in doctors, lawyers, you know, such the other professions. But nobody ever brought in anyone in STEM, in engineering, in maths, in statistics, anything, in computing. Nobody ever brought anyone to just speak to the students and show them what careers are there. And so we decided we'll actually be doing the outreach ourselves. So we currently are doing outreaches in girls' schools, and the outreach is a little bit different. It's just not about talking. We actually do hands-on trainings. So we go into their high schools and tap into their clubs. So we have, all schools have clubs, so which are like usually about an hour or and a half or 45 minutes. And so during that clubs, we have a curriculum that we've developed where we'll either train you in Python development, we'll train you in graphic design, or we do Arduino programming. So just showing you what exactly the tech world looks like. And with that, we've been seeing more girls coming out and actually taking up courses in computers rather than just going into economics or law or medicine and such kind of things. Yeah.
How do the girls feel when they show up? Are they young enough where they don't feel like it's unusual for girls to be doing computers? Or have they already, at the age they come in, have been told by their parents they shouldn't be doing computers?
So when we work with the girls, most of them are at the age of, let's say, 15 and 16 year old. So by then, I think people have exploded, and especially with the way the world has been changing. So now people have been exposed to tech from computers to phones, tablets, and such kind of things. So they come in knowing that, yeah, those things work. But most of the times they are like, I'm not so sure how that will work. I'm not so sure that my parent will allow me to actually venture into that. And so what we do is actually just trying showing them that if you love playing this game, okay, fantastic. Then let's teach you how to make your own game. And that at least generates curiosity. And they actually are like, I can make my own game. And they have wild ideas. So when you start showing them, they can actually turn the ideas into something. You start seeing them opening up their minds and actually being interested. And at the end of it all, people saying, I'm going to do mechatronics. I'm going to do such kind of things. Just being the fact that you've shown them that whatever the ideas are can be turned into applications or systems based on them just learning and being able to actually do it themselves. And so we've had, the other biggest problem is actually the parents. The parents, especially if your parent is not up to par with what's going on in the industry, like at least trying to keep know what's going on in the tech industry. Most parents tend to think that you need to work hard to actually become a doctor. Like being a doctor is really like prestigious in this country. Like you're viewed like, yay, medicine is hard. You do 5 years in school, like in like 6 years in university is a hard thing. So it's prestigious and parents value that. Like even when you listen to parents talking, they're like, oh my daughter is a doctor, you know? And that's like their pride, like they're very proud of that. But nobody says, oh, my daughter is a computer engineer or a computer or a software developer. Like it's not viewed as something prestigious. But but for the parents who are keeping up with the changing technology, actually do realize that it's really prestigious being in the software world. And we've changed that. We've been trying to change that notion because, like, even my mom. Never used to understand what I do. But now she has a problem. She just calls me, you know, you should speak to this student. You should speak to this person. I'm like now the person who just had to like go talking to all those kids who want to do computer science and just tell them how amazing it is. So I think with time, at least we're trying to change the mindset of the parents. And I think that's our biggest problem. At least the kids know that computing has a lot of potential and they can actually be in it. So the problem now is with the parents. But I think with time and as people are growing, and we've seen even with our kids outreach, because we do a kids outreach, and we see parents calling and us, you guys don't have anything, you're running for the kids. I really want to have my kid know how to program. I was like, wow, that's good, because not so many come back asking for that. Mainly it's like we have to really struggle to explain to them why they should go. But now we are seeing more parents coming and asking, what can my kid do? Which I think it's a nice way of changing how things are done, especially in terms of choosing careers for children.
Do you think that the existence of smartphones versus feature phones and the parents seeing and using smartphones is part of the thing that is allowing them to understand, like, yes, that software, you know, yeah, like what software is? Like, oh, this is a game I like to play on my phone, and now my child can make this game too.
Yeah, I think that's contributing a lot. And like, for instance, WhatsApp is revolutionary in here. And so when you try to explain to a parent, like, actually, that one, you downloaded it. Yeah, it didn't come with a phone. That means someone actually built that. And now you install and you're using it. So they're being able to understand that actually people who are building this are young people. They are not like whatever, like crazy people, you know, like the guys at NASA or something like that. So it's actually just normal person like me and you who can actually just write code and come up with an application that makes every communication very easy, and especially in this side of the Sahara. So like, it's quite, I think that's the fact that there's a lot of changing things in the technology industry. It's actually giving them hope that, yay, my kid could actually be a computer scientist. So, yeah, and giving them that option. So, yeah.
So as we close our conversation, let me ask you this. Yeah. You're the lead developer at Ushahidi. Have any of the young women that you've worked with at Akira Chicks gone on to work as software engineers?
Oh, yes. We have very many of the students who've graduated, about 104 from our training program. And so we've seen most girls actually join companies. We've had some working at General Electric. And then we have some who are working at some of the smaller startups here in Kenya, and even SMEs here in Kenya, Cellular and MCOPA, and even at Brick, we have someone who's working at Brick. And so we love the fact that we're seeing the numbers increase. They might be small, but at least we're seeing more women getting into like the hard stuff, you know, such kind of things, like being able to actually go ahead and write code and be brave enough to apply for jobs as software developers and not just get in as a normal IT officer and all that stuff. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm so glad to have chatted with you today. And people can find you on Twitter.
Yes.
They can check out Akira Chicks, AKIRACHIX.com, and Ushahidi, and also Roll Call at rollcall.io. This is a great application. And I love that it says on that website, you didn't know you needed this tool. Neither did we. It is a great tool that I think maybe people don't realize that they need.
Yes.
Very cool. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
And thank you so much for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.